This is Unorthodox, the universe's leading Jewish podcast.
Recording in progress.
That reminded me to record. That was helpful.
Professional podcasters, 3, 2, 1.
Here we go.
This is Unorthodox, the universe's leading Jewish podcast. I am Stephanie Butnick, and I am joined by my two co-hosts, tablet editor-at-large Liel Leibovitz.
Shalom to you.
And I didn't write anything in for you, Josh. I don't know what to say.
I'm a cipher. I'm an actor. I'm a canvas.
And blank slate Joshua Molina.
Tabula Raza, that is I.
Today on the show, we're sharing dispatches from our latest trip to Israel. Liel and producers Courtney and Ellie were there a few weeks ago and got some amazing tape. We're sharing an interview with Lihi Lapid, the former First Lady of Israel. We also talked to John Polin, whose son Hirsch was kidnapped by Hamas on October 7th and remains captive in Gaza today. Plus, we're sharing our visit to the Social Grocery Store, a unique food pantry in Tel Aviv for people seeking asylum in Israel. There is a lot there, and we're really, really proud to be sharing all of it. But first, something exciting that we wanted to tell our listeners about. Liel, fill us in.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing. If you're listening to the show, I imagine that these are really not the best of times for you. I imagine that, like us, you are stressed out and concerned by this unbelievable rise in anti-Semitism, by the ongoing war in Gaza, by everything that's going on in Israel. I imagine that you're asking yourself, what can I do? And here's the thing. The answer is a lot. It's very complicated. But we here at Tablet Magazine want to take one step that I think is the right step to take right now, something that we have never done before, which is to turn ourselves from just, you know, a magazine with a podcast that you'll know and love to a membership organization. Dare I say, the first real grassroots membership organization in American Jewish life in many, many years. Because guys, now is not the time to be consumers. Now is not the time to sit at home and be like, oh, I really want someone else to come and tell me what to do. I really wish someone just made a website where I could click a button and all these problems could go away. These problems are not going to go away. These problems are intense, and we're going to solve them, but only if we solve them together. So we are starting a membership drive here at Tablet Magazine. It is not a kind of fundraising, you know, hey, give us money if you love the podcast type of thing. We're not going to put anything behind a paywall. We're not going to, you know, make all kinds of arrangements where you just support us because you like to support your favorite podcast. Our plans are much, much more ambitious than that. The membership organization that we are building is an organization designed to help all of us, really, because we're all in this together, get through these difficult, difficult times by giving all of you, really, the access to everything that you need. If it's the most amazing, insightful people out of Israel, people that you absolutely have no access to otherwise, to give you an update of what's really going on the ground, whether it's bits of Torah insight, whether it's what to do when my kid's school all of a sudden succumbs to anti-Semitic pressure and makes my children feel unsafe, we are going to offer all of that and anything and everything else that you want to our members. So let us tell you a little bit about the three levels of this membership that we have in mind.
Yes, this special opportunity for Unorthodox listeners to join Tablet gets you so much good stuff. For $36, you get an all-access pass to virtual and in-person Tablet events. Plus, you'll get our weekly member newsletter, which includes your copy of The Tab, a printable edition of Tablet perfect for Shabbat. If you give $180, you're going to get all of that, plus your name mentioned in new member Mazel Tovs. For our high rollers giving $720 or more, you get all of that, and you get to dedicate an episode in honor of a loved one. What better way to celebrate your son's graduation, your niece's bat mitzvah, any occasion in your life? And here's why we need you to do this now, because we are putting on a special Unorthodox Passover holiday boot camp for members. It's a live Zoom with the three of us, our producers, and more. We'll be answering all of your Passover questions. We'll all be hanging out together. It's going to be great.
Guys, here is the thing. Support us at any level that you can. It matters less to us. What matters more is for everyone here. If you love the show, go ahead and become a member. Again, not because we're trying to raise money here for the show, though God knows, yes, we're a small, scrappy nonprofit. We do need the help. But because we are trying to build something much grander. What we're trying to build is an old-fashioned, turn-of-the-century membership organization where people get together. What we want to do is for all these members to be able to come to us. There's also going to be a beautiful new app coming very, very soon. We want a place where you could come and say, hey, it'd be great if you could give me an update on what's going on here or there, or you could give me resources to do this or that, or you could help me and my own community thrive in this way that's particular to us. This is what we're here to do. And to do that, we need you to join us.
We're so excited to invite our Unorthodox listeners to become members of Tablet. To join us, head to tabletm.ag/UOmember or check the link in your show notes.
Who wouldn't want to do an AMA with me? I've been described by Stephanie Butnick as a blank slate.
Oh my God, I'm sorry.
Let me also say testimonial-wise, it's only recently that I've become a co-host of the show, but I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller. Unorthodox is a community that I've been a part of for a long time, and I know what it means to be part of the community and to be exposed to people sharing how they live Jewish lives and hearing the whole variety of ways that one can live and observe their Judaism. And so I've been a part of this community because I loved Liel and Stephanie and Mark, but also because I felt like part of something when I listened to the show, and something that nourished me. And I hope others feel that way and will join us.
Baruch Hashem Yom Yom. And now should we talk about some news of Jews who are not us?
Let's.
News of the Jews. Oh, yeah. N-O-T-J News of the Jews.
Time for some news. This coming from the August Jewish Institution of Manischewitz.
I think of it more as an April organization.
It really is. You're right.
It is August.
April.
It is Aries season for everyone, but especially Manischewitz, because they just debuted an entire redesign of their entire brand, all their products, the matzah, the egg noodles, everything.
They are making gefilte fish cool again.
All Manischewitz products now have this like orange, very striking boxes. What do we think about this rebrand?
Aren't you glad you bought matzah? Sorry.
First of all, I should note that the article that reported this was written by the unapprovably named Bill McCool, which I'm pretty sure, you know, like in Hollywood, if you don't want to like sign your
name.
That's
like
to
Joe
a movie,
Camel. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Right?
You're like, oh, directed by Alan Smithy. Like, I'm pretty sure Bill McCool exactly. is the journalism name for like, I don't want to put my hand in this.
But I'll write the Manischewitz article, but not under my own name.
That's right. But okay, now let's get serious. I got to tell you. Manischewitz, we're about to give you some tough love. What the fabrengen is wrong with you people? Your brand that is all about tradition. The whole thing is that we've been eating your food
tradition
for thousands of years, because I'm pretty sure Manischewitz right. was there at the original Exodus. And, you know, we've been complaining kind of politely, as we do, about everything, but still buying your stuff. We don't want you to be a cool brand with like little puns like, Bubby knows best, you know, that's our shtick. Guys, this is entirely the exact Fabrengen opposite of what you're supposed to be. It actually shows a fundamental disrespect and misunderstanding of what it is that you do and what it is that you mean to us.
He's about to recommend a boycott. I can feel it.
The marketing officer, get this, Shani Seidman, the chief marketing officer of Manischewitz, parent company. By the way, it should not be parent company. It should be mother company if you're the company of Manischewitz. Said, yeah.
Why don't you ever call me Manischewitz?
Exactly. Manischewitz is well known amongst our loyal consumers who buy the brand day in, day out. Also, not true. We buy you somewhere Rosh Chodesh Nissan to, you know, 15 days out. In an effort to update the cultural relevancy with a younger Jewish audience, as well as mainstream culturally curious on it, we've reflected our brand with an exciting new look and feel. Guys, this is like the equivalent of being like, oh, maybe if we do like a disco for young people, they will come to our show. It is the opposite of everything that we know is right and good. No one wants you because you're cool, Manischewitz. They want you because you're Jewish. And if you don't have the courage of your convictions to follow through on tradition, then you're meaningless to me. I am not buying Manischewitz products this Passover. This is my silent consumer boycott. There you have it.
I don't know why I'm surprised, but that is a fiery take.
Good luck with the Gentiles there, Manischewitz.
For a prospective sponsor, look, that is. Those are some.
You know, it's really, really interesting because all of these older, very well-known Jewish brands do struggle with something, which is like everyone knows it because of their grandmother's table, right? But you also do have this need to have more people buy your products. And so I don't malign this as broadly as you.
But hold on. No, malign. Because look, here's exactly what they're saying. You're entirely correct, but here's what they're saying. They're saying, like, people don't want to be associated with something that they experienced at their grandmother's table. They need to feel it's cool and hip and relevant, because God forbid we'll have a Mesorah, a tradition that we will actually go with. No, we need to appeal to the snarky, millennial, relevant cultural vibe. It's so wrong and so backwards, and it shows a fundamental lack of just not having joy and pride in Yiddishkeit. What's wrong with people?
Like, I do see why they wanted to update it, because it doesn't have that, like, the way Moscot or Russ and Daughters, like, goes into the old for their branding. And it could never change at all.
I don't think they're going to lose market over this, but I sure don't think they're going to gain market. I don't think orange is the new black. I don't think hipsters are going to start buying gefilte fish. That's what I'm trying to say.
As hard as they try. Wait, this is so funny. I'm looking at one of these pictures, and there's these really cute little orange and yellow Dutch ovens on these things that say Manny's, M-A-N-I apostrophe Z. That's like the Manny's. It's like Manischewitz. I think this is hilarious, honestly.
And they put products like a t-shirt with matzo ball soup says Manischewitz. The soup with balls. Right, because this is what I need from you, Manischewitz. I need sexual innuendos with my, you know, knedelach. Come on.
Oh, wow.
I'm mainly looking at these pictures and remembering a Passover during college when my friend Julian and I bet our third friend, Mayer, that he wouldn't drink the gelatinous mixture of what was left in a Manischewitz gefilte fish jar for $20 each. And he didn't, we probably had been smoking pot. It wasn't legal then. He drank it, immediately vomited, and put out his hand for the $20 each. Those were my college days.
That is wild and disgusting.
Thank you.
I love the fish jelly, which is why I'm sad that I will not be enjoying Manischewitz jarred fish jelly this year.
What company are you going to pivot to? Give somebody a shout out. And is it going to be, you're going to make your own in the bathtub?
I'm going to bake my own shumara
matzah. The carp in the bathtub.
I'm going to make my own gefilte fish. And for matzahs, I've always really loved Matzot Aviv, which I think is really great Israeli brand.
Okay, I want to flag something else that's very funny, because there is this movement of Passover specific food from the Jewish aisle, from the like ethnic aisle into the broader supermarket, the broader grocery world. And a lot of this happened with Matzah Project, which came out with these sort of like matzah-like crackers that are in the cracker aisle. And they're delicious.
And not kosher for Passover.
Yes. Yeah, that's the thing. They're not actually crackers you can eat for Passover. However, people are eating matzah all year round. There are these sort of like fascinating trade-offs happening, right? I think something's happening where we're going global, guys. We're getting out of that aisle.
Are you saying we're globalists?
We're grocery globalists.
But this is exactly part of the Manischewitz move, right? How about we make something that's really cool and branded and totally not kosher for Passover? Sure, you know what? That's right. I'm pretty sure Jews will find other brands that actually understand what being Jewish is about.
I say let the Gentiles cosplay with their not kosher for Passover matzah crackers.
Our gentilic listeners, you're welcome to gefilte fish in a jar.
Knock yourselves out.
Meanwhile, I will be eating matzah chips all year long.
Let me just say this. I can't stand that brief time. You've done Bior Chametz. You've burnt your chametz. You now can't eat chametz. But you also can't eat matzah until the first Seder.
Right.
That's an outrage. Like, what? There's nothing.
What else is there to eat except for, you know, all fruits, vegetables, meat, fish, right. You know, legumes. Yeah, literally nothing.
Yeah, who wants to eat that?
How long is that period of time?
It's brief.
Five hours.
Hours.
Yeah. You can't carb load and you can't cardboard load.
I mean, what am I going to eat? Fruit? Yeah.
Like, what am I going to eat? Something good for my digestive system?
Forget it.
Why bother?
No.
Honestly, that's all the news we have.
Nothing else happening in the Jewish world.
Nothing else going on that's more important than this. Write in, tell us what you think about the Manischewitz rebrand. Tell us what you think about where we should be in the grocery store. Should we be taking over the full thing, sticking to our aisles? What you think of Jewish foods being cool? Are they too cool? Not cool enough? unorthodox@tabletmag.com.
I'll tell you what, we're gonna find out this coming week whether anyone from Manischewitz listens to the podcast. Check that mailbox.
Or listened to the podcast.
Right.
So J. Crew, I just returned from Israel, where I did many amazing things. You'll hear a bunch of them on the show in coming weeks. But one of the real special things I did was sit down with Lihi Lapid. She is an author and an activist, and also, coincidentally, the former First Lady of Israel, being the wife of Yair Lapid, the once and maybe future Prime Minister. She is also the author of a gorgeous new novel just out in English called On Her Own. It's about a lot of things, but really, it's about Israel right now and about how families break us apart, put us back together again, and allow us to deal with the very, very, very complicated reality of life in this very, very complicated country. I had the pleasure of sitting down with Lihi Lapid at her beautiful home in Tel Aviv and talking about the book and about what it's like living in Israel right now. Lihi Lapid, welcome to your beautiful home.
Thank you. Thank you.
Tell us about this incredible new novel, On Her Own.
It's Nina, an 18-year-old girl escaping from bad people. She came from somewhere in the south of Israel, is escaping to a staircase in Tel Aviv. At the middle of the night, an old woman is going down the stairs, looks at Nina. Nina is trying to think where she can escape to, when this old woman looks at her and says, "Dana, Dana, you came back for me at last." And she's not Dana, but she goes and living with Carmela, and that's how it starts.
And so here we have a young Israeli woman, and the novel begins kind of in this really startling, very upsetting way. She wakes up, she has no idea where she is. She clearly has the physical marks of someone who's been sexually assaulted. And as she's trying to catch her bearings, this lovely old woman named Carmela, who's in, shall we say, advanced slash late early signs of dementia, comes to her and mistakes her for her long lost granddaughter. And from there, this entire story unfurls. But before we go any further, tell me about the process that led to writing something, because you do a lot. You are an activist. You're a journalist. You write a lot of very popular sort of advice books and journalistic writing. And you've had a few great novels before, but this seems to me like something that comes out of a dark, deep, painful, urgent place.
Yes, it's very different from the things I write usually. Those 2 or 3 years that I wrote it, we had like 3 or 4 campaigns of elections here in Israel and here at home.
This is where we should stop and say to those of our listeners who may not be aware that you're also the former and maybe future First Lady of the State of Israel. Your husband is Yair Lapid, the head of Yesh Atid, one of the, or perhaps the leading political opposition party.
I can't believe I talked about it before you asked about it, but okay, I'll say about the process of and the kitchen of writing. It's a lot of noise when you live this life, and especially in Israel, and all the, everything is going inside. And then I realized that after the age of 50, it's a secret no one talks about. Women are not sleeping well, and they are waking up in the middle of the night. So I woke up in the middle of the night and I said, "What can I do?" And I said, "What's going on with Carmela and Nina over there in their staircase?" And I started writing in those twilight zones.
You just had this image. This one image came to you.
I had this one image for 8 years. Long time ago, I wrote it. And then I had a friend that I told her that once upon a time. She's an amazing screenwriter, Ronit Weiss-Berkovich. And she all the time asked me, "What's happening with Carmela and Nina?" And I didn't write it for so many years. And then she SMS'd me one day and she said, "I won't ask about them anymore. If you won't write them, they will disappear." And then I started writing. And at those nights, when I woke up, I started writing and I sent it by email to myself. The morning I made my coffee and I went to visit the text that I wrote somewhere at night. So yes, that's why I think it comes from a very deep inner me.
The characters in this book are on the margins of society. You know, Nina is the daughter of a single mother, Irena, who's a old-time newcomer from Russia. Carmela is an elderly woman with dementia. There's also
her son and his wife who left Israel and live in the United States. There's also Johnny, the not so good guy, criminal who is Nina's abuser slash boyfriend. If I think about you and Yair Lapid, kind of almost in a cliched way, you are the embodiment of sort of the heart of Israeliness. I mean, both of you are known for this line of writing and thinking, you know, what's mach Israeli benecha? What is the most Israeli thing? And we think about you and like, you are the people who help us define what Israel is. And here you are writing about characters who are decidedly to the side.
To the side of
Explain.
So first of all, my biography is a bit different than Yair's. So I grew up in Arad. Arad is the place you stop for toilet on the way to Masada, right? That's the place. And I grew as a desert little barefoot girl over there. And when I came to the center of Israel, I almost didn't understand the language. There were things that kids talked about, and I was asking my mother, what are they talking? I remember this word, chul, all the time. People said chul. So I came to my mother and I said, what is it? And she said, this is chutz la'aretz, out of the country. So in Arad, no one went out of the country.
That was even a possibility?
If
you could leave?
If someone went to... You know, there's a saying in Israel, distance between Be'er Sheva and Tel Aviv is longer than the distance between Tel Aviv and New York. It's harder and longer to come to the center. And I think there's a big part of me over there. There's a big part of me. My parents have a store, and I see we have there a lot of women that are old immigrants from Russia, and I see the struggle of single mothers. And I think at the end, in Israel, this is part of the magic that you study with everybody, you go to the army with everybody, you work with everybody.
Now look, it is an unfair thing perhaps to do to a work of literature that stands in its own right, but precisely because it is a very good work of literature, it does inspire us to think about larger issues. And one of the larger issues that comes across from reading this novel is that, I know, maybe there's something profoundly broken about life in Israel in 2024.
Definitely there is something. It's broken. Our heart is broken. Carmela is a woman that one son of her died in the army as a soldier many, many years ago. The other one lives in America, and we'll talk about it later. But, you know, because I know Carmela, because she's in my heart, every soldier that died since 7th of October, I knew that there's a new Carmela, a new woman, mother, that will miss her son for 30, 40 years and won't be able to be happy anymore. And it's heartbreaking. So I think our heart is broken.
Even though before the catastrophe, I mean, a lot of the, I don't want to call it politics because that somehow cheapens it and suggests it's all about, you know, power. But the real kind of struggle to define what life in Israel would be like, which was at the core of a lot of the protests we've seen even before October 7th, the Kaplan Street protests, the judicial reform squabbles. And it seems from reading on our own that the nation that we thought was more or less a strong, cohesive family is made up of a bunch of really broken families, because all the families in the book are families that are in tatters, right? Irena loves her daughter very much, but her daughter rebels. And also Irena is a single mother and everyone is struggling. Carmela lost one son. The other, as you said, is in the United States of America. Everyone seems incomplete and yearning for some connection. So when you think about this, even before October 7th, because this book was published in Israel in 2022, right? So as we said, as political things were heating up, did you feel you were writing a portrait of a once strong, cohesive family that has fallen apart?
Wow, that's... I didn't think about that. I did think about the fact that no family is perfect. And in every family, we have some struggle. And I think at the end, Itamar that lives in the States, he loves his mother and he wants to help her. And he's just, okay, he was busy with his stuff. And I think Nina loves her mother, Irena, and Irena is willing to die for her daughter. It's just there are times in families when things are falling apart, when things are exploding, when things are... And maybe the question is, how can we mend it? How can we fix it? How can we say at the end, I'm sorry, and hug the ones we love and understand that no one will be perfect. Our parents are not perfect. Our kids are not perfect. And yes, and also countries are not. But I think a country needs to be good, good-hearted to the people living it and not all the time dealing with power.
I may be projecting big time here, but when I read the book, something occurred to me that I thought was a beautiful distillation of Israeliness, which is the whole idea of families both being a source of amazing strength and meaning, but at the same time, that strength and meaning coming at a price that is almost unbearable because these people are in your life, by which I mean to say they really are in your life in a way that I think for a lot of us Americans are like, well, like this is just a lot to take. Talk a little bit about this, about this tension, because it really permeated every page of this book.
I'll talk about this tension because I'm crazy about family. I want to see the kids all the time, even when they don't live here anymore. I see my mother like at least twice a week, if not more. And we are this family that glued together and we are all the time very much a bunch, okay? And I had a brother that lived in LA for many, many years. Part of it, I think it was too much for him, this whole, what you say, getting into your soul, knowing everything about you. It was a little bit too much for him, I think. A big part of the book was writing because I missed him so much and for him to have an American family that are less connected with language, with my parents and things like that. So it's part of it, yeah, yeah. I love the Israeli noisy family interfering with everything. But I'm also a person that, you know, fights with her mother and we are shouting and we are hugging and we are crying. Not for everybody. It's a good thing. So yes, I have very strong families in the book and very connected and very in your face, but that's very Israeli. I know it and it doesn't always suits everybody.
So let's talk about the family in the book that left for America. Carmela's son and his kibbutznik wife, formerly kibbutznik wife, Nama. She has a kind of very wry, I would say, observation of America. She's like, oh, you know, these people are just, they say, how do you do? Hello. They're polite, but there's no realness to them. Was writing this family basically just a meditation on what, and what it means to have family, by which I don't just mean Israelis who left, but also American Jews who, you know, love this place and try to connect to this place, but have very different mentalities.
I'll tell you what, I think there are two ways to live in America as an Israeli or maybe as a Jew. Being a part of community, of a community that lets you feel that you are part of it, that you have, people care about you, that, and there are a lot of Israelis that come to America and they are not part of any community. I think in a way, that's what I saw with my brother, that he didn't have like a synagogue or a, I don't know, JCC or whatever, that he was part of it. And then it wasn't really being American and not being Israeli, and you know that there are the Israelis that are all the time with Israelis, right, and eat hummus, and there are the ones that don't meet Israelis at all. So I think what I tried to talk about is the people that are not connected. For me, it sounds like unbearable. I live in Israel because I love the community. I love the people that I love. Okay, they are my community. And I think if I was in America, I would probably have a community and I was the head of the board of the JCC. I'm sure. So I tried to understand a family that is not connected, not here, not there, that is in between. We call it in Israel, sitting on their suitcases. They will come back to Israel in a year or two or five or 10 or and they are not saying, we are here in America. And they're not saying we're coming back to Israel. So I wanted to write about this. And then they have a lot of things against Israel and a lot of things against America because they didn't decide yet what they are. And part of what I'm saying is when you are somewhere, be there. Be there with all your heart.
Let's talk about being here. It seems like a very candid, emotional work of literature. And I just wonder how a person who is so public, who knows that every word that she writes is going to be, read with a fine tooth comb, has the kind of freedom and wherewithal to say, no, I'm not going to write the sort of proper, formal, monolithic, like correct, oh, this is just another campaign ad or just another publicity shot, but something that is bleeding.
I think I had this struggle at my last book. Its name is Woman of Valor. And I was there really, really struggling because I wanted to write about motherhood and I wanted to write really about motherhood and the difficulties. And then I remember going to talk to Yair's mother, that she's a very famous writer. And she's, so I asked her, listen, Shula, when you write a book, do you write the whole truth? And she looked at me, that was quiet. And she said something wonderful. She said, when you write a book, you write all the truth. And then you erase a little bit. And it sounds simple, but it's not. And what happened in this book, I wrote the whole truth. At Woman of Valor, I wrote the whole truth. I tried to erase a little bit. I couldn't. And then I didn't publish it for a long time. And then after a year and a half or so, I published it with gathering the whole family and deciding that it will be published, because it was the first time I really wrote and talked about Yael, our daughter, that she's autistic and she's nonverbal. She's really challenging.
She's 27
already. And it was something that was, people didn't talk about that. And they didn't, and when they talked, they didn't say those things about that. So that was my discussion about the boundaries between my life as his wife, as a person that a lot of people knows, and writing and art. It was easier for me this time because when people read this book, like you said at the beginning of our talk, it's not about her. How come she writes about other stuff? So it's a lot of things about my life. You remember that there's this thing that she goes to a photographer that will photograph her and it becomes sleazy. So I was a young girl that someone said, oh, you're so beautiful, come and be a model. And I was a chubby, fat girl. I couldn't be a model even if he wanted. And then it became a little bit, and I, nothing happened, but I remember that. And as a young girl with a photographer that is a little bit abusive, and I just said, okay, I don't want to. I don't want this world. But it stayed with me. So each one of us has tips of biography that are wounds in his life. It's first time I'm talking about it. So.
And when you share these biographical things, this part about erasing a little bit of the truth, is this a personal process? Is this a family process? Do you sit and be like, okay, there's some things in this book that might have some people...
My son wasn't able. He got to this abusing thing and he said, Mommy, I can't read something like that you write. Like, I can't. So I said, It's okay. I understand. So, but I think after 10 or 15 pages, you stop thinking about the writer. That's what I hope. And you think about the characters. In this book, I didn't erase a lot. I was a little bit afraid of my brother and his wife, how will they react? But it's a sad story. So.
Now I have to ask. So yeah, how did they react?
My brother was a poor reader. The book was published and then with the book, brother became very ill. He had cancer. And I came and I stayed with him in LA and he died after 6 months. And he knew about the book, but I don't know if he read it. So it was a book that I wrote a little bit for him to come back to Israel, but he didn't have the time. So I dedicated it to him and I missed him so many years. He came to visit, we came to him, but
not the same as living, not the same.
But we had this closure at that time that we were together.
This book will now be read and loved by Americans, Jews and otherwise, who possess few, if any, of the insights and the subtleties of Israeli life and culture. What do you think your average American Jewish reader is going to take away from the novel, and what would you like us to take away from it?
There was something that Israelis told me when they finished reading the book in Hebrew. They said, it's so Israeli. It's like inviting them to visit here. Really, with the bad and the good and the togetherness and the sadness. And especially now, I think after 7th of October is understanding something very profound about living here and being part of this place. And because when people look at us from the outside, they say, how can they pay this price of living in Israel? How am I? I have two kids. One of them is autistic and I will need to watch her for the rest of my life. And the other one is a young, nice guy that I sent to the army. And I want him to be a fighter. And it's, how is that happening to people at our time? How am I willing and wanting my son to be a combat soldier? And this fight in me, is it being a bad mother? Sending him to the army, is it being a bad mother to live here? Is it? And I don't think so. So I want people to understand where it comes from. I hope I'm succeeding.
So let's spend a few minutes talking about this here, State of Israel. Because again, you wrote a very Israeli book. And so now I want to be unfair to you and ask you to share your thoughts about the future of this place. We're here in a very difficult moment in the aftermath of a horrendous attack, in the midst of war, in the midst of diplomatic crisis, in the midst of deep political, spiritual rifts. Take us through your vision of what the future of this place looks like.
I hope, like after a crisis in the family, we'll gather ourselves and we will be better and together. I think this whole super militant, difficult, hard things that we have here, we will try to talk differently. We will try to be different. You know, I think all the time, coming back and thinking about those young women or girls, female soldiers, that were on the border at Tzpitaniot, and they said, we see something is happening, and everybody said, you're hysterical. You're just those girls from good homes in Tel Aviv, you don't understand. And we need to go back and be a society that listens to everybody. And I think we need more women, more and more women in power. And I can't not think about government that was here not long ago that tried to connect all kind of Israelis. And there were almost all Israelis had place in the government that was here. And I hope we'll find the way to work together and not just doing political crushes.
Is it possible? Dare I ask? Because, you know, from where we're sitting, we're seeing a lot of partisanship, a lot of very pro-BB people, very anti-BB people, very pro-conscripting religious people to the army people, very anti-conscripting religious people to the army people. What common ground do we still have?
Wow, you have a huge common ground. When October 7th happened, after a day, people started gathering things, food, and you know, I worked in cucumber field instead of workers that were not there. Everybody did a lot of things. And we know how to do it together. It's amazing.
We're a broken family that's learning now how to come together again as a family.
And even with the big circle of our family, Jews in America, people abroad that loves us, we need to listen more. I really believe, I don't know why, because it can go both ways, but I'm an extreme optimistic. So I think good will win. Yesterday was a very happy day in our family. Yair became a grandfather.
Ah, mazel tov.
Mazel tov. We were outside the room that she gave birth, Shai, our daughter-in-law, and it was so amazing. And you think about new Naomi that joined our family yesterday. It's like, wow, it has to be a great place for her. It has to, and we'll do everything. At nights, I will write books, but during the day, I will fight. I will fight day and night, and I will be on the streets every day, if needed, for this place to be a good place for her.
Lila Pete, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mailbox, got a letter in the mailbox, got a letter in the mailbox, mailbox.
To the mailbox. We are getting such great letters. Please keep them coming. Here's our super listener, Lou Stone, responding to Liel's suggestion to our Jewish letter writer who was asked to plan an Easter egg hunt. He writes, Liel, the idea of requiring the Christian family to have Seder before the Easter meal is brilliant. And if they're true Christians, WWJD, what would Jesus do? He would have been having a Seder.
Mic dropped.
Boom.
Another one about Seders and families and interfaith relations. Dear PodFam, help! On the podcast, we oftentimes talk about family members respecting your right to convert to Judaism. It is indeed a universal right. And the fact that once you are converted, you are not a convert, but you are just a Jew who's found their way home. Amen, Selah. However, here's what I struggle with. In 2 days, my son will be baptized and convert to be a Catholic. I think I would be more okay with it if I thought that he had dug into his Judaism first and then rejected it. He quit after his bar mitzvah. He was an atheist. I think he has fallen under the spell of his best friend. And now he wants to baptize my grandchildren too. How do I wrap my head and my heart around this? Love, Bubby. Wow. Reb Molina, what do you say to Bubby?
You know, Bubby's got to take it on the chin, I think. It's like, take a penny, leave a penny. We lose some, they gain some.
And then they throw the pennies at us.
That's a tough one. If he's met, perhaps one day he'll return. But I think you got to, you know, support your loved ones in the choices that they make. What are you going to do? You can't talk somebody out of this kind of thing. If it speaks to him, it speaks to him.
I want to kind of give rabbinic support to what Rav Molina just said. Look, kind of breaks my heart to hear, obviously, about anyone abandoning a faith that I love so dearly and that animates me. Doubly so if indeed Bubby is correct. And of course Bubby is correct, because Bubby's never wrong, that our beloved Boychik really abandoned a faith that he knew little about. But here is what I think we have to say. I think we have to say that the human heart is complicated and leads us in many places. And sometimes as we watch the people we love go through processes, sometimes we're delighted by their change and growth. And sometimes we have a very difficult time accepting their choices. But to the extent that this nice young Boychik indeed wishes to become a Catholic and is indeed serious about and moved by his faith, I think with all the difficulty, we could do nothing but accommodate him.
And this voicemail regarding a missed opportunity in the Jewish James Bond pun canon.
Hi, Unorthodox team. My name's Karen Bloom. I live in Oakland, California. I have not called before, and I can't believe that the first time I'm leaving you a message is to say this. But when you said octopushy, I said, how did you miss octopushy?
Love it. Octopushy is good. It's a winner. It's a keeper.
Send us your letters, your voicemails, unorthodoxatabletmag.com, 914-570-4869. John Polin has been advocating for the return of his son, Hirsch Goldberg Polin, since he was kidnapped from the Nova Festival on October 7th. John and his wife, Rachel, have met with President Biden, talked with the Pope, and spoken in front of the UN. Our executive producer, Courtney Hazlett, spoke with John about continuing to fight for his son's return almost 200 days after he was taken by Hamas. Here is John Polin.
My name is John Polin. That's P-O-L-I-N. I'm the father of Hirsch Goldberg Polin. Hirsch is 23 years old. He was taken from the Nova Music Festival on the morning of October 7th. He has been held now for 172 days. He was taken critically injured. His arm was blown off before being taken hostage. And we are working all day, every day, to do everything we can to bring home Hirsch and the other 133 hostages. Well, it feels terrible inside. It's been 172 days of misery, but every morning we have a choice to make. We could stay in bed and be miserable, or we can get up and be as productive as possible to bring home our son and the other hostages. And that's the choice we make every single day. But as time goes on, the support that we feel from literally all over the world is incredible. Every day we get hundreds or thousands of messages of support from Israel, from the United States, from Spain, from everywhere. And people tell us that they're with us and they're, you know what? It's kind of like doing a team sport where, like, you've got teammates and you can't let them down. And that's how I feel now, is we are part of a team. We're going to bring home Hirsch and the other hostages. And if we don't make the choice every day to do everything we can, we're letting down the whole group of supporters. And it strengthens us, and it's what we got to do. So you're finding us today in the famous, I would say, Machane Yehuda market, the Shuk Machane Yehuda in Jerusalem. And this is an experiment. We have decided, a group of families, that we're going to take the conversation of the hostages to the nation, to the people. And so we've set up a few little tables here in Shuk Machane Yehuda, and we are here telling stories. It's so easy for people to hear about a number, 134 hostages. But these are 134 individuals with dreams, with aspirations, with families, with lives to live. And we're here telling the stories of our loved ones, getting the story to the people so that the hostages are not seen as a number, 134, but as stories of 134 individuals. And we need to bring all of them home today. So Hirsch is a really curious guy, curious about the world, loves geography, loves travel. He got to spend last summer traveling to six different countries in Europe for six different music festivals. I always say to him, oh, the idea of traveling with you to music festivals and camping out in beautiful places, it all sounds great. The only problem is the music you listen to, which is trance music. He loves trance music, and he's tried to get me to like it, and I think I've got an open mind. It hasn't worked yet. But you know what? Hirsch, when you come home, we're going to some trance festivals. A lot of hostage families wear shirts with their loved ones on them, and I think that's great. My wife, Rachel, who came up with the numbering on day 26, put it on for the first time. And what she always points out is the number is dynamic. When you wear a picture, it doesn't change. But when you put on the number and every day you deliberately pull out the masking tape and you pull out a marker and you have to rewrite the number and stick it on, there's something super deliberate about that and painful. Here in Israel, it's amazing how many people stop and ask what the number is, and even more so when we travel, how much conversation it generates, people wondering, what is that number? I mean, time, these are kind of artificial milestones. Like, I always say, I don't know what the difference is. Like, are we in March? Are we still in October? It all feels the same. But yes, 6 months, even though it's artificial, we feel that pain.
Can I just say hello to you?
Yes.
We're traveling here. We've been here for 18 days from Philadelphia. This is my father. He's 94.
Hi, you look great.
Yes, you look strong.
I want to tell you, at home, I follow you and Rachel on social media, and I wear a piece of tape at home since the day she said on social media to do that. Every day, I change the number, and when I'm out, and people say to me, whether I'm at work with my clients, what's that number? And I say, that's the number of days hostages are being held. And I just need to tell you, from the bottom of my heart, we care so much. In Philadelphia, in the United States, no matter what you see on the news of all the anti-Israel media, there is a group that is thinking of you and Rachel and your family. And please give Rachel a hug and let her know that Philadelphia, our family, the United States cares, and Hirsch will be home.
Amen. Well, thank you so much for stopping by. Thank you for saying those words. It's been 172 days of misery, but I say the only good thing that has come out of it is the strength and the unity that we feel from people like you all around the world. And it matters. So please, hopefully they come home today, but until they do, don't stop. Don't stop everything you're doing.
And we know they are coming home. We know. We know. Thank
God
you.
God bless you.
That the war will stop now? No, the question is that.
Here's what we want. We want the hostages coming home today.
Yes, but Israel
is a strong country.
I understand the suffering of the people. I understand. But you have to know that if we stop now, we will have 7 October again and again and again.
You know what? We live in a dangerous neighborhood.
Yeah.
And we're a strong country. And we're going to deal with whatever the consequences are because that's what we know how to do.
It's interesting to me the gumption that people are coming up toe-to-toe with the families of hostages and arguing their side. I just couldn't but also this is my side, but also I don't know if it comes from being a parent and I'm thinking about kids and yeah, I don't know, it's just
chutzpah is the most important word you need to know living here in Israel.
Yeah,
so I think today we came out as 8 families, I want to say, plus a few additional volunteers who have been amazing. All in, we're probably 15 volunteers and family members here today. And like I said, this is the first time we're doing it, and 2 hours into it, I would say it's been amazing. The people coming by to get strength from us and to give us strength, more importantly, and to take home stories that they could take and spread, I think it's amazing. And I'm sure that unless the hostages come home today, that we're going to repeat this event and take it to other parts of the country. For people who pray, you can pray for Hirsch and all the hostages. For people who are into psalms, recite psalms for Hirsch and all the hostages. But really, I think probably the easiest thing is we wake up every day. It's been 172 days of waking up and thinking, uh-oh, today's the day that the story just falls off the news cycles because the next thing hits. And we cannot let that happen. So help us elevate the stories of Hirsch and all the hostages. You can follow us at Bring Hirsch Home on all social channels. You can follow the broader hostage story at Bring Them Home Now on all social channels. Read the stories, spread the stories, add to the stories, but don't let the story of these 134 people who are sitting somewhere in Gaza, don't let their stories fall off the radar. Help us spread and raise and continue to spread the awareness of all these people. Today, let's bring them home.
The social grocery store in Tel Aviv offers fruits, vegetables, and cooked meals to people seeking asylum in Israel. While these stateless residents wait for their asylum claims to process, they can't access social services. The social grocery store helps keep them afloat if they lose their jobs during pandemics or wartime. Our producers Courtney Hazlett and Ellie Blyer visited the social grocery store to meet its founders, volunteers, and customers. Have a listen.
Look at these little cuties with their costumes for Purim. Hello.
Levana.
This is the garden in front of the Social Grocery Store, a food pantry in Tel Aviv. We were there around Purim, so some of the kids walking in with their families were in costume.
Shalom.
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 Shalom. Meninim. And those are jets flying overhead in the background. The Social Grocery Store is set up like any other grocery store. Except the items on the shelves are all free, and the families walking in are all stateless. They've left their home countries behind for one reason or another and are now seeking asylum in Israel.
The social grocery store is actually the only food pantry for this population in the entirety of the country. It is the only resource at this scale that affords food security to this population. There is no other project of this kind in the entire country.
That's Natalie Silverleaf. She helped found the social grocery store in 2021.
In Israel, the asylum seeker population have little to no access to rights or social services from the government. They are under a protected status. They won't be kicked out. So they're here, but they're here in a very unstable situation, and their status is also unstable. At any point, the government could change their recognition of the community and the policies, and so that instability causes further harm to their mental and emotional well-being.
Most came from Eritrea or Sudan, leaving terrible situations for the relative safety of the Jewish state. Here in Israel, they found places to live and jobs to do, often in restaurants and hotels. And then many found themselves stuck. Asylum claims can take years to process, leaving people not just without a state, but also without state social services. You can get by until things get bad again.
So imagine during the pandemic, everything was completely shut down. And overnight, the hospitality industry closed completely, office buildings closed completely, and this population lost their livelihood within the blink of an eye. We were really on the brink of a humanitarian disaster because this community had nothing to fall back on. And unfortunately, there were no other resources available to them.
One of the few places these stateless families could go was Mesila, Tel Aviv's Department for Migrant Services. Or Baton worked there with Silverleaf in 2020. She saw firsthand just how deeply people were struggling.
What happened during the pandemic, as Natalie said, people lost their job and they were hungry. Mm-hmm. So we had lots of people standing outside the Mesila gate asking for food and formula and diapers. They weren't able to buy any food. So we just gave them whatever we got from donations.
They handed out what they could, but it wasn't enough. They needed more food. And different kinds of food. The Eritrean and Sudanese families who needed it had different cultural and dietary needs than your average Jewish Israeli. So Bitan and Silverleaf opened the social grocery store in 2021. It now serves hundreds of families. Once Mesila refers asylum seekers to the food pantry, they can visit every week and pick up what they need when they need it. And the experience once they get there, it's like going to any grocery store. You choose the items you like. Silverleaf says it's set up this way to treat their clients with dignity.
As opposed to us dictating what their diet should be and holding all of the power, we're providing them the power and them the choice.
So as you can see here, we have signs in three languages. This is Tigrinya, the language they speak in Eritrea, Arabic for the Sudanese community, and English for the undocumented community. And we are distributing the food according to the family size. If you are one adult with one child, two parents with three children, it's different amounts of food. And all the food that's on the shelves here, the food that we are buying is according to what the community wants. So every time a shopper comes, we are registering what they took, and now we know what they prefer, and we are changing accordingly. The food here is answering their dietary preference.
The food pantry stocks its shelves by buying food directly and by accepting donations from food rescue organizations like Leket Israel, which collects leftover food from farms and supermarkets. They try to balance staples like fruits and vegetables and ingredients for traditional Sudanese and Eritrean dishes.
Injera, so they need the lentils and they need the tomato sauce. And we have pasta and rice. They use a lot of rice, flour and canola oil. And then we have more for the kids, the tuna, the corn, chickpeas. I can't see.
It also stocks hygiene products, winter coats and children's books in different languages. It tries to feel like home. The people stocking the shelves play a big part in that, whether they're Israelis or recent immigrants themselves.
Salam from Eritrea. Yeah, you can speak in English.
My name is Salam from Eritrea. I am here, Ken.
12 years
here in Israel. Now I'm here in Shoshar grocery store.
How many years are you working here with us?
Almost three years.
How old are you?
29.
And how many children do you have?
I have three children.
Do you like working here at the social grocery store?
It.
What do you like about it?
I like with people. I help what I can. I help them.
All of us close.
This is Ethan.
I'm Eitan, I'm 29 years old, like Salam. Working here like 9 months, something like this. And I very love to work here because it's not only groceries. It's like it's to speak with people, to be kind to people, and you can meet them. And when I go outside, I always say, like our customers, I say, and we speak, and it's very nice. And sometimes they update us. Sometimes they just say hi. Sometimes they sit outside 2 hours, and we play with the kids and with the Filipino woman in Khamishi. One an hour, we smoke outside cigarette. They bring papers. We help them with papers. It's very important to me.
Sometimes the workers and volunteers will help the customers with paperwork in Hebrew. Sometimes they'll chat for a while. Often, they're just learning about each other while bagging groceries.
When I hear something, yesterday Salam told me, when I open apples, in Eritrea, apple cost like 100 shekel. Like it was so expensive, it was only for the rich. And she said, in Israel, it's not like this.
We met one volunteer who'd been at the store so long that he'd helped put up its first shelves.
Hey, my name is Modi. I started here 3 years ago to volunteer. I'm coming once a week. And I'm happy. I'm already know the customers, and it's nice. I hope this project will carry on, and we can help the community.
When Modi got his pension, he volunteered in a few places around Israel, but he stuck around here for a reason.
I'm helping myself by helping them. I think, and I see, that the politicians and governments, not all the time, see the people in front of their eyes. Unfortunately, not only in Israel, but here as well. And this community needs help. So I'm happy to do the minimum I can do as a volunteer. But they're not getting what they want, to be an Israeli. There are people without identity. Some of them have kids 15, even 17 years old. They're absolutely 100% Israelis. They're born here. But still, they have no passport, or so they cannot even go to the army. They want to go to the army. They're an Israeli. They speak fluent Hebrew better than me.
In the eyes of the state, these asylum seekers are not Israelis. Maybe they will be at some time in the future. But for now, they're vulnerable to any sort of instability. That was clear during the pandemic, and it was extremely clear after October 7th. Here's Silverlieb again.
So we support each month 600 families, and that's thousands of people collectively. Each month. And on October 10th, we're open Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. On October 10th, we were here. We were operational. We had to be operational, especially in times of crisis and especially in times of war. That's the stability that we provide. Our presence provides that stability to the community. They can rely on us. October 10th, all the way through the end of November, looked at a ramped up distribution of an additional 875 families on top of the 600 that we were already serving, who were provided fruits and vegetables and cooked meals. It was about 1,500 portions of prepared food, of cooked food, that we distributed during that time.
After October 7th, many more people all over Israel are at risk of going hungry. People can't move back into their homes. Farms can't be tended. It's hard for everyone.
But this community always seems to fall through the cracks, especially at Misila and for fundraising for this project. It's always challenging fundraising for the asylum seeker community. But even more so now, where it's a community where their well-being is already compromised, given their status in Israel, given what they have been through to arrive here, given the uncertainty of the future of their children, of their own future.
Silverlieb has been impressed by the money raised throughout the world to help citizens displaced by October 7th and the war. But she wants some of that money to go to people who may not be Israeli, but are already living like Israelis.
These are human beings living here, experiencing what I'm experiencing or anybody else that's here is experiencing. When sirens go off, there are no bomb shelters in their homes. They have to run. I'm fortunate enough, I have a bomb shelter, you know, right outside my door. Some people have them in their house. They don't have that. So it's incredibly terrifying for them. And they don't have the access to the resources that they need to provide them some level of comfort. And all of the kind of mobilization of new funds that have been transferred to the Jewish Israeli communities, that has not been available to this community. But this community, they're here. They're living here. They're part of it. They're part of the story of October 7th and after. They're a part of it. There are over 22,000 asylum seekers just living in Tel Aviv. Over 6,000 of those are children. They're here. They deserve assistance. They deserve to feel some type of safety. They deserve to have some fragment of stability. They often get overlooked before and now more than ever. So I think they need to be recognized as a part of the response efforts and the funding that is being distributed.
For now, the social grocery store continues to do what it does best.
How does it make you feel to fill up that bag?
It's nice. I'm happy for her, yes. It's very good. It's wonderful, no? You're excited yourself, no? I can fill it back for you as well. It's nice. It's very nice. Here.
All right, time for some Mazel Tovs. Who wants to kick us off?
I would like to wish a very ironic, acerbic, poison-dipped Mazel Tov to the New York Metropolitans, the Mets, who really, in pure Metsy fashion...
Good start.
...started this year in an unbelievably bad fashion, not just being swept, but playing like the bunch of lifeless, weak schmageggies that they are. And here we are again in another quote-unquote rebuilding year, another year of a heartbreak, another year of wandering in the desert. Really, Mets? Really? Don't ever change.
The bench is cleared. The bench is cleared.
Twice!
Yeah, I think we're just getting it out of our system and it's going to be a wonderful season.
And I want to make this personal. I have a shout out, a Mazel Tov, to my mother-in-law, Wendy Cohen, who took my daughter, Edith Cohen, to New Jersey for a special weekend with them. It was amazing. And an ancillary shout out to my brother-in-law, David, who came out there with his daughter. They had a whole cousin's weekend. I have the most amazing family. I feel very, very lucky. I got a lot done this weekend, is what I'm trying to say. And I appreciate them for everything.
I'm going to Mazel Tov it forward by shouting out everybody that was moved by our plea and is going to join us, all the people who are going to join us as members in ever-increasing multiples of 18.
Baruch Hashem.
I love it. Unorthodox is a production of Tablet Studios. The show is hosted by me, Stephanie Butnick, with Liel Leibowitz and Joshua Molina.
Thanks, Lee.
We're produced and edited by Josh Cross, Robert Scaramuccia, Quinn Waller, and Ellie Blyer. And our team includes Tanya Singer and Cordy Hazlett, with help from Sam Hacker and Jordana LaRosa. Our episode art is by Esther Werdiger. Our logo is by Jenny Rosberg. Our theme music is by Golem. And our news and mailbox themes are by Steve Barton. We love to hear from you. Email us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com or leave a message on our listener line, 914-570-4869. Until next week, may we all be blank slates. Shalom, friends.